You are listening to Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Ryan Adams.
And today we have a kind of a big announcement on the show, so we're going to do things a little differently than we usually do. This is Ryan's last episode co-hosting the show.
That's right.
And taking over from him going forward will be Neil Lawrence, who's also with us.
Thank you.
So we wanted to take the opportunity to interview Ryan, because we've never done that on the show before. So, Ryan, we ask all of our guests the same question first. How did you get where you are?
Let's see. So, I grew up in Texas, and I went to MIT for my undergrad, and I got my degree in electrical engineering and computer science. And it was not a smooth trajectory through my undergrad. I got kicked out a couple of times, but eventually, after spending some time in industry and sorting some things out, I eventually went back, and I was really excited about artificial intelligence and related ideas. And I have this very sort of distinct moment at which I sort of started down the path that has led me to sort of like to be a machine learning researcher, which is that there was a used bookstore in Davis Square in Somerville, Massachusetts, that is now long gone. And we were sort of like poor students wandering around this this used bookstore, kind of like looking at books as one does. And there was this book called Talking Nets, an oral history of neural networks. And this was a book that contained a series of interviews that had been conducted with the people who were responsible for the first round of sort of neural network research. And so no mention of deep learning and so on in this. And it had interviews with Terry Sinofsky and Jeff Hinton. So I read this book and I thought, this is the stuff. This is the thing that I really want to get into. And it also had like an interview with Jerome Letvin, who was this kind of neuroscientist and one of the people who worked early on with like McCullough and Pitts. Mm. And he had said at some point in the book, he was kind of emeritus at MIT, and in his interview at some point he said, oh, if only some undergrad would come work with me to do like this, you know, cat neural system analysis stuff. And I was like, I'm an undergrad at MIT. I can go, I'm going to be this guy. And so I emailed
wait, this was a secondhand bookstore.
Yeah.
So how long after the book published is this?
I'm not sure when the book came out.
I think it was like mid 80s or something.
No.
Later?
1998.
Really? Oh, yeah.
And so I tried to track him down to no avail. Although a couple of years later, in a very bizarre sequence of events, I was on a deep sea fishing boat in the Gulf of Mexico with my family. And the guy standing fishing next to me on this boat, as through small talk as you do, he sort of, introduced himself, told him I was an undergrad at MIT. And he's like, oh, maybe you know my uncle. Do you know Jerry Letvin? And I was like, what?
I thought you were going to say he was going to ask, he asked you to help him with a project, and it turned out to be Jerry Levin.
No, this was much younger. This was like Jerry Levin's nephew. And I was absolutely floored by the fact that in like the Gulf, 40 miles out in the Gulf of Mexico, I had like, met the nephew of this guy I'd been trying to track down in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and unsuccessfully. And so then he like sent an email intro and invited me to a dinner that turned out to be very uncomfortable. And because he was actually like not that interested in having an undergrad who cared about science, like at this point, it was like quite a bit later, and he was kind of not active at that point. Nevertheless, it was a really strange coincidence. What did succeed was I emailed the one of the authors of the book named Charles Anderson, who's at Brown, doing sort of cognitive science. And it was spring break. And he just said, hey, you know what you should do is just come down and hang out with me at Brown. For a day, and just, we can talk about this stuff, which in retrospect is unbelievably generous. I mean, at the time I felt like it was generous, but as I've become like a busy professor, I've come to appreciate that I would essentially never do that for an undergrad. You know, and I mean, I don't know, maybe it was a different, you know, different career stage for him or something, but nevertheless, he made time for me to like come down and hang out and have lunch and sort of meet other people and things at Brown, and in a way that I'm actually kind of floored by. And let me sort of like tell him all the things I was excited about with neural networks, and he was super patient and stuff. And even though I was a total nut job, and so then I sort of was looking for, you know, like how can I get into this field? Like, you know, so this is like 2001 or two. This is 2002, spring of 2002, and he said, well, you know, MIT just hired this sort of you know, great young researcher named Joshua Tenenbaum. And you should track down Josh when you get back and see if, you know, if he'd be an interesting person to work with. And if that doesn't work, then why don't you try another person to talk to is Leslie Kelbling. And so I got back to MIT and emailed Josh, and he never replied. Which is hilarious because, anyway, Josh and I now years later have like written papers together and co-advised students and things.
Still doesn't reply to your emails.
He never replies to my email still, but yeah. And but then I emailed Leslie, and again, very much like with Charles Anderson, you know, she replied and let me become a part of her lab and would meet with me regularly and gave me career advice and let me like write a really crappy senior thesis and, you know, do the kinds of things that undergrads do. And again, I'm floored by her generosity. So in the lab at the time were some people who would go on to sort of start other labs and who would become well-known in the field. One of these people was a postdoc named Kevin Murphy, who was in her lab at the time. Yeah, so Kevin was a postdoc with Leslie.
Yeah, that's right. I'd forgotten.
And again, he was very patient with me. I mean, I was playing with these robots trying to sort of develop, you know, do some probabilistic modeling, policy search type stuff that before it became hot again. And I very distinctly remember interacting with Kevin where I was trying to estimate, you know, where the walls were in the room based on this noisy sensor measurements from this big like trash can sized robot. And I was like, okay, well, you know, I take some measurements here and then the robot moves a little bit and then I take some more measurements. And now I've got two different kinds of measurements about where the walls are. How could I ever combine these different noisy measurements into one coherent estimate of where the walls are? And he's like, Bayes' theorem. I was like, I don't know what that means. Well, I mean, I had seen it, right? Like I had seen Bayes in this, you know, in this.
That's like, mainly what Bayes was about, like working out how to move robots around rooms.
Well, what it is about is this question that I found this like deeply philosophically troubling. Like, which of these measurements of the world is the right measurement of the world that I can trust? How would I ever combine different sensor modalities into like a single observation model, or like into a single model of the world? And I had seen Bayes' theorem in, you know, in like probabilistic systems analysis classes, and, you know, and it just looks like an identity, which it essentially is. Yeah. But I think we all like see, there's a gap between recognizing that this identity is true and appreciating what it means for problems like sensor fusion and collection of multiple observations and noisy data and things like that. And so it totally washed over me, and I didn't get it at all, and went on with whatever ad hocery I was doing. So I didn't learn it. I didn't learn that from Kevin. It would have been a good person and moment to learn it. But at a different time, I talked to him about where I should go to grad school. And he said, he pulled out this copy of David Mackay's book and that he had just written. And this is the information theory and, you know, learning algorithms book. And said, I just got this amazing book from David Mackay, who's really great and is at Cambridge, and you should check it out and, see what he's about. And I didn't know who David was, but I looked into some of the stuff and I thought, okay, you know, this guy's doing some really cool things and he's in this amazing place. And so I emailed him and eventually arranged to come over to Cambridge to visit. And I sort of made concurrent arrangements to visit a couple other places around, including the Gatsby unit in London. who rejected me, and I don't think Peter Tyan like thought I was very interested in neuroscience, and I had this amazing
be right.
Yeah. Well done. Peter.
Well, they had a lot of applications as well, I guess.
Yeah, well, Zubin was there.
Yeah.
And I had this amazing conversation. Again, this is like one of these things where you like unwind it later, and you realize what you were talking about at the time. And Zubin was kind of like, you know, doing this sort of probing, somewhat technical conversation to see if like I would be a good grad student. And he said, imagine on the whiteboard that
he developed an English accent.
What's that?
He developed an English accent.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I have an English accent. Imagine. I don't. Yeah. With his like generic Western. Yeah. American accent. Imagine that you had a bunch of points like from a function. And you were trying to, let's say you were trying to find the minimum of this function, and you didn't know exactly what the function was. And, you know, and so what would be some different criteria for thinking about how you might choose new points to evaluate, given that you don't know what the function is, that would be good for, you know, good at next points to try to find this minimum. And I got really wound up about not understanding the, like how he could be reasoning about the space of functions without reference to a particular finite basis. Let's say that without sort of thinking about what the particular finite regression model was, I was kind of like hung up on this, and I ended up not understanding why you needed to look at tail probabilities of this model and so on. Anyway, the point is that he was literally interviewing me based on whether or not I could sort of grok the idea of Bayesian optimization.
It took you another 11 years.
And I was like, I don't know, I disagree. Like, and he was trying to get me to, appreciate the idea of expected improvement. And I did not appreciate it. anyway,
this is 2001, right?
This is 2003 about 2003. Now. Or yeah, this is 2003, at this time. But
that wasn't like, he was kind of asking you questions that would have been considered fairly state of the art research, and you have.
Yeah, he was. PhD. So, and I would say that actually he was trying to get me to talk about it without knowing what a Gaussian process was. And I would not understand what a Gaussian process was for several more years. But it's kind of tough to talk about flexible Bayesian regression when I had just finished misunderstanding Bayesian, Bayesian modeling from Kevin Murphy. And also like certainly wasn't going to appreciate the non-parametric version of this. So I got pretty like hung up on not understanding how Zubin could possibly be talking about these like super flexible models without parametric forms.
Yeah.
And so I had a hard time seeing past that, in addition to misunderstanding other things. So this is another thing that in retrospect, I think is hilarious, where he was like essentially interviewing me on this thing that would later become a big part of my research program. And in 2003, I think like it could have been become a big thing in 2003, right? Because like all the pieces were there, right?
The
in fact, it could have, I mean, all the tools for this had been around for a while, but, And some folks had kind of written papers around this Gaussian. I think there's a couple of Gaussian process optimization papers, and of course, there's like Jones's work from the late '90s and so on. But yeah, he was trying to, I think, kind of feel me out as a potential grad student. And then obviously between him and Peter, I didn't succeed. But David did accept me.
Not interested in neuroscience. Neither does he understand.
And he doesn't understand anything about Bayesian optimization, which was true. But David did accept me.
That's actually one thing that I think a lot of people don't realize, because you're actually talking a lot about, you know, half of your story so far has been rejection, or let's say two thirds of it. And I think that that's something which we all experience. All our stories are exactly
the place where I wasn't rejected, it was generosity.
Yeah. But it's hard for grad students when they're going through the same thing as you to understand that this is what everyone else seems very successful.
Yeah, well, you only see their highlight
because
reel,
you don't, because yeah, you only see the positive example.
No, that's right. Actually, I think it's kind of important to talk about
I think it's very important
about this stuff. So David David decided that, and in fact, I John Wynn gave me this like tour, a little tour of Cambridge. It was a very nice visit, and then I ended up deciding to go to Cambridge, and then I started in 2004, like fall of 2004, and at St. John's College.
That was my college.
Yeah.
And it's Zubin's college too.
Yep. Yep. And Steve Gulls, and it's kind of like
Steve
Gulls. Yeah. It's that was really a lot of fun. Like I have very, very fond memories of Cambridge. And David was, you know, like we all do, I had a complicated relationship with David. Or like we all have complicated relationships with our PhD advisors, and I had a complicated relationship with David. He's pretty demanding. He was very demanding from a technical point of view. And I felt like I spent the first several years of my PhD with a combination of two kinds of things, where one is I would be sort of gradually reinventing things that were, that were like decades old. Or I would be trying to come up with new ideas that David could either instantly come up with a counterexample that demonstrated why this was a bad idea, or sort of draw the simple little picture on the page that, in 1 minute that shows why it's a bad idea. and this is one of those things that's frustrating as a grad student, but is a really fundamental asset of somebody like of your PhD advisor, is that they can rapidly give you insights into things you're working on, of course. But, so very slowly, I felt like the horizon of like how long ago it was that the thing I'm reinventing was originally invented, that gradually started getting smaller. So initially I was inventing things that were like hundreds of years old, and I would go to like the library at the Department of Applied Math and Theoretical Physics and find the book in which it was like considered obvious. And then gradually it became decades old. And then gradually it just became, single digits years old. And then at some point, I felt like I sort of like crossed over and was able to think of things that weren't already in existence. And this was about the time where I started sort of getting excited about Gaussian processes. And part of this was certainly that, Neil, you came in and gave a talk about your Gaussian process latent variable model. This would have been in about 2006, maybe five. And I think in engineering, I think, yeah. And I very distinctly remember you talking about, you showed, I think, some of the mocap stuff that you guys had done, and some of the oil well modeling. Is that what it is?
That was
Oil processing.
Oil flow. Three phases oil flow data.
And so that was one of the. I remember that being one of the sort of ways I started to sort of understand what Gaussian processes were about. And so I kind of became obsessed with this question that I think a lot of people have thought about, which was how to do density estimation with Gaussian processes. So Gaussian processes are this very nice tool for thinking about regression. So, interpolating between points in a flexible way. But some of the other kinds of problems we solve are density estimation. You see a bunch of points and you'd like to figure out kind of what probability density they have. And this was really hard because it placed constraints on the Gaussian process that didn't exist in the regression setting, in particular that it would be need to be non-negative and it would need to integrate to one, and that's a very awkward thing to ask from a Gaussian process. And I spent a lot of time trying to think about how that could possibly work, and variously kind of didn't make a lot of progress on it for a long time. And I think quite a few people around at that time had been thinking about it. And sort of simultaneous with this, my wife was doing a PhD at Penn State University in biological anthropology. And so we had a transatlantic marriage that really sucked. And so at some point I just decided that it was time to move back to the States. And David didn't really approve of this, but I decided I was going to try to like continue working and write up and everything from Pennsylvania. And at some point I sort of felt like I kind of at least partially kind of cracked the nut around how to deal with some of these constraints on Gaussian processes as they relate to density estimation. And then started working with Ian Murray on this stuff, who at that time had started a postdoc in Toronto. and wound up kind of ended up writing a thesis about this kind of thing, for which you were an examiner, about sort of density estimation and ultimately like Poisson intensity estimation and semi-supervised learning and some other things. And I felt very lucky that I'm sort of in this time, you know. So David was this amazing advisor from a technical point of view, but I didn't feel like I got a lot of guidance from him on professional things. And there were just a couple of, again, like very lucky things that in retrospect sort of blow me away. And one of them was that Zubin Garamani would, who had rejected me from Gatsby a few years earlier, would spend about a month, a year or thereabouts at Carnegie Mellon.
CMU, yeah.
And in Pennsylvania. And it wasn't that close to Penn State, but it was close enough that I could drive out. And because he was away from the group, even though he's a very busy guy, you know, he was kind of isolated a little bit and didn't have students with me. And so he would amazingly make time to meet with me when I would go out there. And we could, and so he helped me sort of think about things that would become my thesis and some other work, and in particular helped me think a lot about kind of what to do professionally. And kind of how to think about whether I wanted to become an academic and like how to actually do that, the kind of guidance that, you know, David just wasn't really well suited to give. And so I had this kind of incredibly lucky coincidence of getting this amazing technical, you know, technical advising and mentorship from David that had a tremendous influence on my life, while also having really amazing sort of professional, well, and still also technical guidance from Zubin, but I don't know how I would have navigated anything like in the absence of Zubin making time for me in Pittsburgh. And so I wound up, you know, writing my thesis, and along the way, as I was kind of doing that, went up to Toronto to visit Ian Murray, who was there, and via those trips, met Jeff Hinton and Rich Zimmel and Brendan Fry. And was very fortunate that they sort of ended up liking me enough to help me get a CIFAR Junior Research Fellowship. And this was kind of a funny thing because the world has changed a lot since then. When this was like 2009, I guess, 2008, 2009. And CIFAR, this Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, was the kind of the funding kernel for what would become deep learning.
Yeah, this is 4 years in to the grant, yeah, or something, right?
Yeah, this was a few years in and into the rebranding. And, you know, and this was the sort of very explicit sort of cabal formed by Jan and Yashua and Jeff to try to jumpstart interest again.
But importantly, with a very visionary grant that backed them for 10 years.
Absolutely.
An area that no one was looking at.
They
were looking at, I thought it was kind of cool, but it was a big bet.
I totally agree. So it was the Neural Computation and Adaptive Perception Program, the NCAP program, and that they had given these guys who were in many ways like kind of out of favor, right? Like they were working on things that weren't at that time very mainstream. I mean, and you know, when they gave the grant a few years earlier, and this was, as you say, this was a few years in, and this program is the thing that funded my postdoc.
Yeah, I think
directly.
I wrote your letter for that.
That's almost certainly true. Thank you. And
I think there's a story there. I think I sent initially someone else's letter to Jeff instead of your letter. And Jeff went, oh, I think you seem to have sent me the wrong letter. Very nice letter, but
I don't think it's going to be.
I don't know how I did that. And yeah, anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had an amazing time in Toronto. And then Brenda did this. My wife did the same kind of thing where she wrote her PhD thesis from Toronto, and much to the chagrin of her PhD advisor. And it was an amazing time to be in Toronto for so many reasons. One of which was, this was a couple of years, so this was like 2009, 10, 11, where people were starting to realize that neural networks were good for stuff again. And GPUs were just emerging. You know, Alex Krizhevsky, you know, nobody's really thinking about these things. And then I think Alex Krizhevsky went and took like some kind of training course with NVIDIA. I mean, this may be wrong, but my recollection is he went and took some training course and then wrote you know, CUDA ComNet, like, kind of wrote the some of the software that would allow you to do ComNets with GPUs, and at the same time, George Dahl was there as a grad student working with Jeff, started to tackle started to tackle speech recognition, and there was just this kind of like, and Ilya Sutskever was there, Hugo La Rochelle was there, Marco Aurelio Ronzato, and Ian, of course, and Danny Tarlow, Jasper Snook, and so there was this great, it happened to be the case that they had this great set of postdocs, and some of it was because the NCAP program, but also because the, for complicated reasons, you know, Sam Royce had left Toronto and had been at Google and then at NYU, and then of course he passed, and but one of the side effects of that was that they kind of had Sam's money that had to be spent, I think, and they used it to get postdocs like Ian, I think.
Now, I think something really interesting about, which I really like, because I think it's so true, but again, it's, people are unaware of how true it is. 90% of your story so far has been about people.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, we've talked about like two or three ideas which you've touched on, and you got interest in those ideas because of people. And I guess a lot of people think that the whole thing's about ideas and maths and so on and so forth. But the communication of those ideas and the inspiration of those ideas is so much driven by people. And you say lucky, you say, oh, I was lucky and this thing happened. But I think part of that, you're kind of quite a personable guy. And when you show up, you know, certainly inoffensive, I would say. People enjoy having you around, and when that's true, then they share things with you, and yeah, people really enjoy working with people that they get along with, and yeah, that's a real core thing. You know, that's almost more important than any idea, and this is something I never knew. You just sort of think before you start in science, well, it's going to be all about the ideas and not about the people, but the people are pretty important, aren't they?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the ideas are a lot of fun. I love the science of this, but.
Well, and also, you, as you pointed out, David's touch on the ideas was vital. Yeah,
and it's just, but day to day, what makes it fun, right, is the people you work with. And one of the really wonderful things about being a scientist and being an academic is that you get to choose who you work with, right? And, you know, if there's a collaboration you're not having fun with, or there's a good friend that's also in the field, then these are situations where you can not collaborate with one person and start a collaboration with somebody else. And you have this confidence that, you know, you guys will be able to come up with something fun to work on. And what I think is most interesting is to surround myself with a set of friends where we all love kind of the same kind of science. And that's why I love coming to NIPS. I come here to see my friends who love the same kind of science as me.
But the other thing is that the intertwinedness of these stories, because I'd never really thought about it either. You were talking about Ilya and Alex and the GPU, and of course we're just on the cusp of the deep net revolution, or the I mean, it was ongoing, but the moment where it hit outside the field.
Yeah.
And of course you have also, in some sense, you're about to tie the story back together, so I should let you get it back onto me in terms of what you published that same year, which is one of the most cited NIPS papers as well.
It's true. I mean, and that work, sort of the kernel of that, we definitely definitely grew out of Toronto, because that set of people even though we went our separate ways. So this is Jasper and Hugo. We started working together, and at that time. So yeah, so it was just a very it was a golden era for that group in Toronto. Different groups, different places go through different kinds of golden eras, and you can kind of in retrospect see when it was just the right people at the right time all together, and without a doubt that larger machine learning community in Toronto over that span of years, that was a really great time.
So when did you go to Harvard? That was
so I went to Harvard in 2011, and started building a group there. In the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences in 2011, and in it over the next sort of several years, managed to get some very, very great grad students and postdocs and have a lot of fun doing a lot of different kinds of things. One of which was the stuff you referred to, which is this work on Bayesian optimization that we spent quite a lot of time thinking about and ultimately founded a startup centered on that we then sold to Twitter. You know, and that that work was, it's a funny kind of thing because really what we were doing when we did that work was trying to solve a problem for ourselves. You know, we were in Toronto, we were working on deep neural networks, you know, as you do. And we had some crazy idea on how to regularize a convolutional neural network. Like some, you know, if we introduced these 12 hyperparameters into a convolutional neural network, then maybe that would be a really good idea. And then it was kind of, well, shit, how are we going to set these hyperparameters? And so then I remember Joshua happened to be visiting or something, kind of came into the office and he was like, what if you use Bayesian optimization? Because I think he was thinking about how to set hyperparameters kind of at the same time, but had done a kind of, I think Bayesian optimization maybe hadn't worked for him, for the stuff he had wanted to do. But it sort of happened to coincide also with work like Ian and I had been doing on Gaussian processes and MCMC. And so I think we had a kind of a good set of tools for handling the computations of Gaussian processes. I think we were just right on the moment with elliptical slice sampling and other kinds of ideas to be able to kind of do MCMC that worked in a sense for GPs that had been harder before. And it was just things were kind of like right at the right, just happened to be there at the right moment where there was a set of problems that people really cared about that were kind of hard. And a couple of, you know, relatively small technical insights on for ideas like Bayesian optimization that have been around for a long time. But as importantly as anything, just like wrote a piece of software and then put it out and like made it available. And that is a wildly underrated thing to do, is to write a relatively simple piece of code that's meant to solve problems that people have. Like that's the thing, like write a tool that's useful and then make it available to people. And you will, it seems like you will often discover that the problems you think you have are just not that unique and that people might well be very happy that you release this tool. And so I think that's kind of what happened there. I don't think it represents a breakthrough really, but kind of a lot of little things that made it practical. And in fact, the word practical wound up going into the title of the paper because that was kind of the point. Like here's a kind of like a, it's an applications paper for machine learning. That is, we're going to treat machine learning seriously as an application itself and try to offer some practical considerations for solving these problems.
So, Ryan, thank you so much for being a part of the show, helping to create it, for all the time and energy that you've put into it. It's been really amazing to work with you.
It's really been a lot of fun.
And Neil, I'm looking forward to working on the show with you and seeing how it evolves over the next season.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. They're big shoes to step in. In fact, they're sort of large cowboy boots, which I certainly could never wear. So I think Ryan's done a tremendous job, and the entire idea is fantastic. So I just hope I can do some justice to the idea. It won't be as good.
I can't wait to tune in.
Well, that's it for us this week. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Ryan Adams.
And I'm Neil Williams.